I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. No one has claimed responsibility for the bombing attacks in Boston on Monday that killed three people and injured 176. The FBI point person, Richard Lesorier, told the public someone knows who did this. They were someone's friend, neighbor, or coworker. We are learning more about the bombs from the surgeons who have been working on the victims and from law enforcement who have recovered small ball bearings and nails and what appear to be parts of pressure cooker devices. We asked Cooper University Hospital trauma surgeon Major John Chavanis to join us on Radio Times. He served three combat tours with the U.S. Army Reserve Medical Corps in Iraq and Afghanistan. He also provided medical care at the World Trade Center after the September 11th attacks. And Major Chavanis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty.
You know, I have to say, and I think we're all reading, if we dare, some of the descriptions of the injuries. They are chilling. They are gruesome. They have been described as blast injuries. How should we understand, I guess, the injuries that the people in hospitals in Boston are dealing with?
Blast injury is a devastating constellation of injuries. It's not only the pressure force. So think of a high-speed motor vehicle collision on an interstate. That's one component of blast injury, so this massive blunt force. And then there's the component of the penetrating injuries. You hear things of ball bearings and bomb fragments. We sometimes use the word shrapnel, but really it's all these different fragments. So high-velocity penetrating injuries like multiple gunshot wounds. And then, depending on the proximity of the victim or the patient to where the point of detonation was, there's now the burns, that whole component of burns. So this is not just in a single patient. This is, or this is in different patients. This is in a single patient is suffering from every type of wound you can imagine occurring simultaneously.
And what we're also learning is that these are injuries to lower extremities. What do you think that tells us about the bombs, or if it tells us anything?
I'm far from a bomb or explosive expert, so I can't tell you about positioning or the forensics part of it. However, just like we would deal with frequently in Iraq and Afghanistan, whether someone is walking, and we call that dismounted patrol or mounted patrol in a vehicle, normally the bomb is positioned lower on the ground. And when the vehicle drives over the bomb or someone walks by and detonation occurs, it normally means it starts at a lower positioning.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like an IED, as we understand that?
It seems almost very, very similar. Very similar. When I hear about the projectiles, that would be just a common way of what we deal with overseas. Very similar projectiles.
We're reading about and hearing about the heroic efforts by medical personnel in Boston, and you served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Have we learned about how to deal with these kinds of injuries because of these two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yes. You know, as a trauma surgeon, we're at a very busy trauma center here in southern New Jersey. We deal with many injuries. And I took that experience here from Camden in southern New Jersey and took that overseas. Well, likewise, what I learned overseas, I brought back here to Cooper. And many other surgeons have done that. So it actually is an area where we kind of share, cross-pollinate. And you hope this information, we do a lot of lectures to our peers here in the civilian world, that information gets out. And it sounds like Boston and the surgeons and the medical teams were well prepared for this.
I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to sustain some of these injuries. And based on your own experience, does someone go into shock, for instance, if they've lost some of their limbs? Are they in pain?
Yes. Yes to both questions. The shock is profound, and realize it's not just one patient that's coming into your trauma bay. You may have many patients. So with these severe injuries, many patients at once. It's truly a mass casualty incident. And the patient comes in, and whether the limbs are missing, many times the amputation's already been done because of just the blast force. But they'll come in severe shock, and part of the care, the important care, is proper resuscitation. Can we get blood on board, the right kind of blood? fast? Do we have bleeding control? You've heard a lot about tourniquets.
Right.
You've learned in the battlefield tourniquets are crucial, and we lost that lesson here in the civilian world. We brought it back. So as far as pain goes, people are in shock, but mentally, a lot of times, they're still with it, and so they do feel pain. So pain control is crucial.
Well, it's interesting what you say about tourniquets, and I've been reading that as well. Something learned on the battlefield, the importance, I guess, of tying up whatever wound is bleeding out.
Exactly. Think of your blood vessels, high-pressure system, the arteries and the veins. If a limb has now been removed, that vessel's exposed. So massive, rapid blood loss. And we used to, in the old days, when I was a young EMT and paramedic growing up, we had tourniquets, and they were kind of dismissed in the civilian world 25 years ago. Well, we forgot about them, and then we learn on the battlefield, well, we're seeing these massive injuries, and a simple tourniquet in the right injury, it has to be massive, applied, is life-saving because it stops that severed artery from exsanguinating, just the blood loss being overwhelming.
I'm wondering, too, because obviously with the Boston Marathon, there were medical personnel on the scene there. Has that helped deal with some of these injuries? And I heard a trauma surgeon say that there are two people now in critical care. A number of people have been taken off that list.
That list is kind of evolving. Obviously, when the wounded start coming to the trauma bay, you're saying they're more critical till you sort through everything and see how they evolve. But they will probably start to if they can get these folks through the shock, they'll have a long recovery, but they should be able to kind of care for them better and get a better idea of what their injuries are as time goes on.
And that's Major John Chavannes. He's a trauma surgeon at the Cooper University Hospital over in New Jersey. And we called him up to help us understand what medical personnel are doing in Boston dealing with the severe injuries as a result of those bombings on Monday at the Boston Marathon. Any questions you might have for our guest, the phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm reading something that was in the New York Times today, Dr. Burke of the Boston Medical Center, basically talking about, you know, when is the right time to, frankly, amputate a limb. One of the things he said is that early amputation can mean a quicker return to normal life. Trying to save a limb can mean possibly many, many operations and many years of recovery. I'd be curious about your thoughts about that.
It's a very difficult call. As a trauma surgeon, you have to balance the saving of the life over the limb preservation. And if you make the call incorrectly, then the patient can die or be handicapped severely with this not functioning limb. So it's a difficult call. And if the traumatic amputations occurred from the bomb blast, then that decision's done. You're resuscitating. But when it's the gray area of a mangled extremity, the decision is you have to make it fairly fast, and you don't want to try to cause the overall demise of the patient. And so it's a difficult call. I'm sure they're making the best call with the information they have at hand. But if you wait too long, it can pull your patient down.
Yeah. I'm thinking about the kind. I mean, you train for these kinds of emergencies, but I'm also thinking about the kinds of stresses on doctors and nurses and medics and paramedics dealing with this situation.
Yes, it's you know, it becomes part of your fabric. As a trauma surgeon, we're at a busy academic center here. It's kind of in your blood, but you never want to lose the humanity of being a compassionate surgeon. So you have to kind of develop certain walls to keep distance, but I mourn every patient. Mm-hmm. I mean, you need to always have that compassion as a surgeon. So you have to be hardened, but if you get too hard, I don't think you're being a good doctor.
Well, and you have to deal with the aftermath of this, the recovering patient and their family.
Absolutely, and the family is just as important as the patient, frankly, in many times. They're involved. They want to know what's going on. Multiply that over dozens of victims or in the battlefield when the family here is, you know, 6,000 miles away. So So you want to involve them, but there's a balance. You can't always spend as much time with every family member that you'd love to, because there's just so much time in a day.
Is there a need for blood in Boston, from what you know?
I don't know. I can tell you that blood is crucial. What we've also learned on the battlefield, so many lessons. We could talk for hours.
Sure.
But blood administration is life-saving. And what we learned in the battlefield is whole blood. Whole blood. You lose blood, you get blood back. Appears to be life-saving. It sounds like Boston had enough robust system, the Red Cross, excellent organization. But the idea that's also starting to evolve is whole blood. We resuscitate with whole blood. You lose blood, not just IV fluid, not just packed red blood cells or components, as we call it, but they should get whole blood. And in the initial stage of the disaster, it sounds like they've had enough. I haven't heard that they haven't, but that's part of, even on a Saturday night here in the Delaware Valley, blood sometimes gets short, and we need people to donate blood. It truly is life-saving, and people donating blood helps.
We've been talking about what you and other doctors and medical personnel have learned on the battlefield, but I know that you were part of a team of people that went to the World Trade Center after the September 11th attacks up there and helped to provide medical care. You were even involved in saving what appeared to be maybe the last person at that tragic site.
Yes, I can't believe in some ways it seems so far long ago. I was a surgical resident in training and I grew up as a paramedic and always just believed in action and trying to help the wounded, and realized New York City needed help, and went up there. Sometimes I think maybe it was foolishly, but ended up rendering aid, a long night of caring for a wonderful police officer who was trapped deep in the basement, and helped take care of him. But, it was, hundreds of people helped there, thousands helped care for everybody up there. I was just part of that team.
But do you think we have learned also, and we're almost out of time here, but that we've also learned from those kinds of disasters what to do and how to help people in Boston?
Absolutely. I think that, the silver lining of all this is that it's made our trauma system more robust, our emergency response system more robust. We learned about better communication. Now we have to make sure to apply all those lessons. But I think, yes, silver lining, horrendous disasters, horrendous. But we have to use these lessons so we care for the next round of wounded. And that cannot just be a bomb. That could be a bad collision here on Interstate 295 with some young children that get in a wreck, or somebody who falls down steps. Those lessons apply to all wounded in our society. So we do learn things from this, and we have been applying them.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you joined us today in Radio Times. Thank you so much, Major John Chavannes.
Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. He's a trauma surgeon at Cooper University Hospital in New Jersey, served three combat tours with the U.S. Army Reserve Medical Corps in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have another conversation, which we will have right after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Sony Classics, The Company You Keep, a new thriller directed by and starring Robert Redford, with Shia LaBeouf and Susan Sarandon, about one man's journey to outrun the FBI and his radical past, starts Friday.
The Mann Center supports WHYY. Tickets are available Wednesday, April 17th for the Mann's 2013 orchestral concerts. The Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra performs a Jerry Garcia symphonic celebration featuring Warren Haynes and Disney's Pixar in concert. The Philadelphia Orchestra returns with Symphonic Sportstacular, a new Legend of Zelda Symphony of the Goddesses, a tribute to Van Cliburn, Michael Feinstein and Friends, and more. Tickets for these and other concerts at manncenter.org.
This is Terry Gross. Join me Sunday afternoon, May 5th, at the McCarter Theater in Princeton for Off Air with Fresh Air. I'll talk about my adventures hosting Fresh Air, play clips of interviews in which things didn't exactly go as expected, and then you could give me a taste of my own medicine during the Q&A. There will be more to see than just me. We'll have animations by WHYY's digital artist-in-residence, Tony Off. For information, visit whyy.org/events.
Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance supports WHYY. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance is offering information on how to protect kids at pa-fsa.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. As details surrounding Monday's bombings at the Boston Marathon unfold, we are continuing our coverage on Radio Times. We just said goodbye to trauma surgeon John Chovanec. Joining us now to talk about how the nation, the people, and the government is responding and coping with this most recent attack on American soil are Ron Fournier, editorial director of National Journal. Prior to joining National Journal, he worked at the Associated Press for 20 years, most recently as Washington Bureau Chief. And Ron Fournier, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Heather Hurlburt, Executive Director of the National Security Network in Washington, D.C., and served in the Clinton administration. And Heather Hurlburt, nice to have you with us as well.
Great to be back with you, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Heather, if I could begin with you. Interestingly, yesterday, President Obama said this was an act of terrorism, something he didn't say on Monday. How significant do you think that is?
So there's a legalistic answer to that, Marty, and then there's a political answer. And the legalistic answer is what he said was it was an act of terror. And act of terrorism has a specific meaning under international law. Act of terror just describes what we all felt as we saw the event. What it signifies is an attempt by the administration to cut off some ugly political debates that were starting. You know, what it clearly doesn't signify, because the FBI has come out and said this twice a day, is that they have some specific idea that some particular group or individual was behind it.
To you, Ron Fournier, are you seeing ugly political debates starting to unfold over in the last day or so?
Yeah, it's kind of striking. You have two layers going on. One publicly, you already have Democrats and Republicans kind of on the edges in Congress, trying to score political points. On the Democratic side, there's a few who've linked this to sequester, the cuts that were made, and wondering if Boston's going to be able to respond with a lack of money. And already some Republicans in Congress almost cheering for the culprit to be a foreign national, so that might undermine immigration reforms. The second layer is out in the public. And if you look at Facebook, if you look at Twitter feeds, if you look at comments on articles, there is a lot of hate out there. And there are a lot of people who are looking to point fingers, and it's kind of scary.
Yeah. I mean, and picking up on that, Ron, which obviously, you know, Twitter has its good parts, which is, of course, helping people deal with an emergency, a crisis, a trauma, and then its darker cousin, which, of course, full of conspiracy theories and frankly, you know, racist commentary.
Right, which, you know, Twitter just reflects the both the angel and the devil on all of our shoulders, and there's no barrier from a thought in somebody's head to broadcasting it publicly now, and sometimes it can be kind of ugly.
Heather, do you want to add to that?
I do, because I think spending too much time on Twitter at a moment like this or on any electronic medium is really gives you a little bit of a warped picture, and not at all disputing that there are a lot of really, really frightening and hateful and sad people out there. But if you compare what's actually happened in the streets in Boston and around the country with what we've seen in the aftermath of past attacks, there's been really heartening outpourings of interfaith support, of support across political lines, of vigils involving Christians, Muslims, Jews. So you can choose to look at Twitter and be very disheartened about human beings, or you can choose to look at what's actually going on in Boston and be pretty heartened about, you know, who we are as a society and how far we've come and how concerned we are. And I mean, one other thing I'll say is that the mainstream media, it's not perfect, but it's doing a decent job with some large exceptions, but it's doing a decent job of not scapegoating, of not pointing fingers. So, you know, I think it's really, really important not to give the kinds of extremists who are out there scapegoating you know, the credit mm-hmm. or the oxygen of letting them define our national discourse, which they don't.
Well, if I could just quickly,
yeah,
if I could
go
just
ahead,
quickly,
Ron.
I would just like to quickly agree. You're exactly right. There are some incredible stories of real true heroism, simple people who, instead of running away from the explosion, ran towards it and helped the people in really dire and dangerous situations. And like I said, you can see both the best and the worst of people on a day like the other day.
Well, Ron, and even just picking up on this, and this is, we're struggling with this on Radio Times. We're down in Philadelphia. We're not even in Boston, and trying to figure out, you know, what is the kind of conversation that we want to have about what appears to be an act of terror in the United States, and not wanting to get too out in front of the story, and yet knowing that people do want to talk and they do want information. I'm sure it National Journal, you're wrestling with that as well.
Yeah, and I think as the other guests very very smartly indicated, we can't forget two things. One, that this is still the greatest country on earth, and we are a great people, and we're gonna move on and recover and be better for it, like we were after 9/11 and after past attacks. Also, though, we have to face honestly the fact that every time we get hit like this, it does change us to some degree. Doesn't make us worse, doesn't make us weak, doesn't make us bedwetters, but it does change us. And when we have an attack on something as innocent and inspirational as a marathon event, mm-hmm. and you know, innocents are slaughtered like that, it has to change the way we look at security and safety in this country without it changing our basic human spirit.
And Ron, if I may, you wrote that yesterday, and I really disagree that it has to do that. I mean, you know, you and I are both old enough that we grew up in the 70s when there were many, many airplane hijackings. Actually, you know, quite a bit more domestic terrorist violence than there is now. And, you know, with quite a bit higher fatality levels than there are now. And we didn't think that every one of those incidents had to change us as a society forever. And, you know, while not wanting to minimize the amount of both individual pain and group trauma that happens, I think we just have to be really careful about the idea that there's something that we're granting whoever it is that did this some kind of instant success. And I really contest that, and I don't want to grant those people any success
Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, and neither do I. These are despicable people, and we should not we don't do anything to give them any solace. But it's not granting them success to acknowledge basic facts, like it does affect the human psyche when we see people get blown up at a public event, and it's just the fact that life did change after 9/11, and we now have thicker layers of security and a little less sense of security than we did. It is a fact that the public feels like this is a less safe, less a secure and honorable world to be raising their children, and we really do worry about where the future of the country is going. That doesn't mean that that's not a negative thing to say about the country, and it certainly isn't giving the terrorists a quote-unquote victory. It's just acknowledging that big events can have a big effect.
Well, and Heather, let me just pick up on something you said, because, again, I'm looking at the New York Times today, a story about the Global Terrorism Database. And to be perfectly honest with you, I was surprised to read that there were many more attacks and many more people targeted by attacks back in the 1970s, and that these numbers have dropped dramatically in recent years. And yet, as Ron said, I think a lot of people feel, people have told me this, you know, it feels like we live in a much more dangerous world.
Well, Marty, this actually goes back to the very first point you made, that, and, you know, it didn't fall from Mars that we feel differently now than we did 10 years ago. That happened because our media and our political leaders, you know, chose to talk to us in certain ways and urge us to respond in certain ways and made certain policy choices about what we see when we go to the airport, just to pick one example. So, you know, this isn't a chemical reaction. It's ways that we as a society and the leadership that we in our society choose to respond to this. And just one other thing, you know, that I want to mention about this, that Ron, you said, that's absolutely right, that seeing this kind of image changes us. Mm-hmm. And it does literally change our brains. And one thing that has changed dramatically since the 60s and 70s is how much more of this violent imagery we can see, that we can all sit at our computers and endlessly hit refresh on those pictures from Boston, or we could see the kids at Virginia Tech, or we can watch the towers fall again and again and again. And neurologically, that changes our brains. And so in some ways, you know, we as a culture are now, we've built this cycle where we're doing it to ourselves.
What do you think about that, Ron? That's interesting.
Well, I think, yeah, that's very interesting. I'd like to think more about that. I mean, let's go back in history, the 1910s and 1920s, when there was people getting blown up on the streets of Boston and Wall Street, you know, the anarchists. What kind of reaction might there have been if we'd had Twitter, if we'd had, you know, smartphones shooting pictures of limbs around the world? It's a very interesting point. How much of this is chemistry, in your words, and how much of it is the influence of the media and politicians who are forcing those changes? I hadn't thought of that that way. It's very smart.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Ron Fournier. He's editorial director of National Journal. Also with us, Heather Hurlburt, executive director of the National Security Network. We called them up today in Radio Times as we continue our conversation about the bombings in Boston on Monday. Of course, much we don't know, but as we have been talking, there are things to talk about. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Heather, let me go back to you, because I also, you mentioned the media, that you think by and large the media done a pretty good job with some exceptions. But I'm also thinking, we don't know who did this or what groups did this, if they were international, if they were domestic, if it was a kind of a lone wolf. But I'm wondering, all this attention, all this talk, all this conversation, whether that feeds something in whoever did this.
Well, one of the things that I've been comparing it to is the Atlanta Olympics bombing, which took years to track down conclusively who had done it. And we know that that perpetrator did feed off of the idea that there was this manhunt that was unsuccessful. And, you know, there was no Twitter and no Facebook and no, you know, sort of daily me back then. So I do think, you know, and it's one of the things I find most haunting, and frankly, one of my hesitations every time I get an invitation to go out and talk about it, is, you know, is there someone somewhere who's just really enjoying the fact that instead of talking about gun safety legislation or immigration reform or any of the million other things that you and Ron and I could be talking about, that we're talking about some individual or some group?
What do you think, Ron? Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
Well, no, it's a very good point, and of course, let's not forget that we all wrote hundreds of thousands of words about a suspect who was later cleared in Atlanta. We're all wrong about that.
Do you think, though, that Ron, that, and this is, of course, broadly speaking, that journalists are a little more cautious about identifying people because of what happened, the wrong person being identified in Atlanta?
Yeah, I think a certain number of journalists are. The problem is the definition of journalist has changed dramatically since the Atlantic City bombing. Everyone is now a journalist if you have access to the internet. So the standard has been lowered very broadly.
Let me get Ron from Chester, Pennsylvania, to join us on Radio Times. Ron, go ahead. You're on the air. Hi there. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just wanted your guests to comment on the fact that with all this saturation of coverage of the event and the 24/7 news organizations we have, doesn't that give the perpetrators the notoriety and the publicity they're seeking? I'm not that we can't cover it, but you know, it just seems like that's all everybody is talking about, which can be a good thing, but at the same time, I just think it's overdone. Like, I'm getting worn out of all the total coverage all the time.
Well, that's interesting. Ron, I'm going to toss your question to Ron, and perhaps it's how things are talked about as opposed to just talking about them.
Yeah, and going back to my earlier point, that there are so many media outlets now, there's so many ways to get this information and have it flung at you, that there is no sense of proportion, because there's no proportion in the media anymore. So we have to cover a story like this, but we is no longer three networks and two major newspapers and a couple wire services. We, the media, is now just about everybody who has access to computers. So and you know, cable news, and it's just There's just a flood of information out there, and I even feel like I've heard too much about this now.
Interesting. Heather, have you heard too much?
Yeah, you know, this question of proportion, I think, is a really interesting one, because I'm struck that if I am on Twitter, I feel like nothing else but this is happening, and I still feel this incredible sense of immediacy, and my pulse races a little bit. If I step away from Twitter and slow down and actually pick up a print newspaper, there's lots of other things going on in the world I can focus on. If I look at my email or, you know, go talk to my colleagues, there's all kinds of stuff I can focus on. But we now have the ability as individuals and as communities to get sort of totally caught up in something and experience, you know, this kind of secondhand emotional trauma. And then, you know, that sells, so the media keeps doing it. And so, yes, I'm sick of it too, but I keep clicking on it because there might be something I'm missing. And I think, you know, there's a very deep sort of problem of human nature that we're bumping up against here, that we now have the technological means to do stuff that really isn't good for us.
Ron, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Ron Forney, let me go back to you. And Heather talked about, and it is inspiring to hear these stories of people in Boston, you know, running towards these blasts to help people. I'm also thinking of the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, where teachers, you know, covered up and protected their students, the children in the classrooms, as a kind of just a reminder that there are these other stories. I mean, they almost sound like a cliche, like a Hollywood movie or something, but these are real as well.
Yeah, and you know, it's something as a parent, like all parents, I taught my kids to, you know, not get in cars with strangers, make sure, you know, someone shows you ID. But I also taught them that, you know, people are just generally good. They're really this country and this world is filled with just people who just want to help other people. So it's, but we forget that, you know, especially like Heather says, in an era like this where it's so easy to just focus on the bad. It stands out as an exception, but it's really not. When someone like this gentleman who I read about in New York Times today, who lost his son in Iraq, runs towards the explosion and helps save somebody who lost a man who lost both his legs. Those really aren't exceptions. We help each other in small ways all the time, stopping to help somebody whose car's broke down, pick up a $20 bill that somebody dropped. The human spirit is really, you know, very strong, especially in this country. But boy, it's easy to get dragged down mentally when you're connected to the worst of the world electronically.
Heather, anything you want to add in the 30 seconds before our break here?
Judith Herman, who's a Harvard psychiatrist who basically invented the field of post-trauma care, talks about something called tend and befriend. She says we all think of fight or flight. We've been taught that that's what our brains are wired to do, but our brains are also wired to tend and befriend. And the more we focus ourselves toward that, the easier it is to heal both as individuals and as communities.
And that's Heather Hurlburt. She's executive director of the National Security Network based in Washington, D.C. Ron Fournier joining us from the studios of National Journal, where he is editorial director. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, talking about a whole host of things related to the bombings Monday in Boston. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Legacy Recordings, presenting Willie Nelson's new album, Let's Face the Music and Dance, a new collection of songs from the American country singer-songwriter. Available at Amazon.com.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, with day and residential options, is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have the latest on the investigation into the Boston Marathon bombings. When, if ever, will this city get back to normal? Also, the world still turns, so we'll check in on Capitol Hill and gun legislation. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Choose PA Wind supports WHYY and encourages energy consumers in Pennsylvania to power their businesses and homes with energy from in-state wind farms. More on clean, local wind power online at choosepawind.com/Philly.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about how the nation, both its people and its government, are responding, coping to this most recent attack on American soil. Our guests are National Journal editor Ron Fournier and Heather Hurlburt of the National Security Network. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Mary from Philadelphia to join us. Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to make a statement. I think that this type of bomb was compared with the IEDs, but also nobody mentions that the radical form of the IRA used this type of bomb in its unrest with England. And there was a sense of apathy here in the United States because it wasn't happening here, but they were the same type of horrible bombs, to the best of my knowledge, that was used then. And I just wanted to know what anybody thought about that.
Okay, Mary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Heather, I mean, there's much we don't know. And again, I don't want to get ahead of the story. Any thoughts to Mary's call?
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out that, unfortunately, if you're anybody of any ideological stripe coming from any place in the world, this type of device is one of the first things you learn how to do, that there are recipes, quote-unquote, on the Internet in all kinds of places with all kinds of ideological affiliations for how to make a bomb out of a pressure cooker. Mm-hmm. So it actually, you know, this technology, if you want to call it that, has been around for a long time, and it does absolutely not point anywhere, and it also, you know, raises the point that terrorism has been with us for a very long time in small and large ways, and the technology of terrorism has been with us for a long time in small and large ways.
And Ron, I mean, this is sort of grisly, but thinking of pressure cookers and then going back to September 11th, those were box cutters. I mean, these are everyday materials.
Yeah, and the one thing that struck me about this was everyday materials in an everyday place, and it was the question I raised in the article yesterday, and I would love Heather's take on whether or not she thinks we're entering into an era where the new normal is attacks like this on places like schools and malls and churches, these soft targets, which is something we've all worried about since 9/11, but it never really has happened, thank God.
What do you think, Heather?
Well, if you look, as you mentioned, Marty, that the overall number of incidents and lethality of incidents has been trending down. In the 70s, attacks on airplanes were pretty normal. I actually grew up near Montreal, I lived in your listening area for a while, but lived in Montreal or near Montreal for a while in the 70s, when there were routinely attacks on civilian terrorist targets in Montreal by separatist groups. There were routinely attacks in Puerto Rico, by the way. The most terroristed part of the United States in the 70s was actually Puerto Rico. So this isn't a new normal. This is an old normal. You know, the new normal is what we were talking about before, how able we all are to know about it and feel affected by it.
And again, that's Heather Hurlburt, who joins us along with Ron Fournier. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Heather, let me go back to you. And I'm looking at actually the Tuesday edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Of course, the front page was all the things that had happened in Boston and what was known as of yesterday. I flipped it over, and here's the headline on page A6. Series of car bombs kill at least 55 people across Iraq. And you know, you don't want to compare and contrast these two situations, but this is a much more everyday occurrence in places like Iraq.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that the Boston attacks were actually the third or fourth most lethal attack
anywhere in the world in that 24-hour time period. There were attacks in Iraq. There were attacks in Pakistan. I believe there was one in East Africa also. We were so fortunate as a society that we did go through this period at the end of the Cold. You know, in a way, Ron, maybe another way to say what you're saying is that we had this period in the 80s and 90s where we didn't have many domestic attacks, you know, that in some ways ended in retrospect with Oklahoma City or even with the first World Trade Center bombing, although we didn't recognize it at the time. Right. But, you know, so that in fact there was an old normal of political violence in this country, and we had a couple decades where it went away, and now it's back.
Yeah. Does that seem to fit with your understanding, Ron?
Yeah, it does. Although Heather's putting it in a much better perspective than I had before I came on the show. Next time I need to call Heather before you write.
Myself as well. But I think it should also be said, and they're probably, if I can go back to you, Heather, again, which is that there are things that we do know that the government is doing, and then there are things, of course, that we don't know that the government is doing in dealing with this whole issue of national security. And I'm assuming there are just things behind the scenes that we might never, ever know about.
So, yeah, because nothing can be ruled out. So you will have people going through every transcript, every intercept. Was there chatter overseas that we missed? Are there people that we are worried about who've been moving around? They'll be checking in other places. Who's celebrating? Who's suspiciously not celebrating? At the same time, there are a number of domestic extremist groups that the law enforcement and the FBI also keep an eye on, and they'll be looking at them. So, you know, occasionally some of that bubbles into the surface. There'll be, you know, sort of trying to trace all the components, some of that being very kind of obvious old-fashioned gumshoe work, others of it very sophisticated chemical and metal spectrum work. So yes, there's just an enormous amount of stuff. And most of it, it's also worth saying, most of it will be entirely fruitless and lead nowhere.
Right.
And so you know, we saw the first responders and the incredible, you know, courage and dedication they showed. But you think about being somebody somewhere who has the same pictures in their minds that we have and is trying to track down, you know, where a ball bearing came from or where a scrap of cloth came from or whether a comment on an intercept means anything or not. And, you know, spend a moment just to think about how many public servants whose names we'll never know, whose pictures we'll never see, you know, many of whom aren't even allowed to tell their families about what they do, who are trying to solve this today.
Well, and Ron, it's been said a number of times that, of course, at an event like a sporting event in Boston on Monday, is everyone's there with their cell phone camera. I mean, there is so much information. Of course, now we've gotten used to living with cameras on the streets as well.
Yeah, although there's not nearly as many cameras on the street in a organized way as in American streets as there are in, for example, London. Although New York, Heather would know better than me, I think.
Yeah.
New York might be closer. But there is a heck of a lot more of video around an act like this than there would have been, obviously, in the 70s or 20s.
Well, and I'm thinking as editorial director at National Journal, you've got reporters fanning out to cover this story. Is this a different story to cover than a, you know, I don't know, I don't exactly know what to compare it to, but is this just a regular investigative story from your perspective? That's to you, Ron.
Regular. It's hard to use that word around an act like this, as Heather says, that was so visible and is such a big story. It's a hard one to get our hands around because, especially if you're a news organization that's not pretending to know more than it knows.
Right.
And, you know, we really do have to give these investigators a time and the space to do their jobs and to try to make sure that we can separate the wheat from the chaff. It's even hard when you're talking to folks, you know, quote-unquote, on the inside. There's a habit of a lot of sources, including in law enforcement, to try to sound more knowledgeable to reporters, even on background, even in a private conversation, than they really are. And an important job of a reporter is to be able to discern between the people mm-hmm. who really do know and are passing you on something that's important and valuable, or those who are just trying to shuck and jive their way through a conversation. And the oldest dodge in journalism is to have something that's wrong and say, oh, well, my source must have been wrong. Well, no, if your source was wrong and you distributed it, you were wrong and you messed up.
And there is always the danger of repeating something that's incorrect, and it begins to take on a life of its own, Ron.
Yeah, either you're repeating something that's incorrect that's been broadcast by another outlet, or you're repeating something that's incorrect and bouncing around inside of an agency. Either way, it's shame on the reporter for doing it, but mm-hmm. it's awfully hard to tell truth from fiction in this kind of a fast-moving story with this kind of competition.
And Heather, you had mentioned you felt, you know, broadly speaking, the mainstream media was doing a pretty good job with some exceptions, but as someone who's been so part of national security, are there unique special responsibilities, you think, for reporters covering a story like this?
Well, you know, first to just second what Ron just said, you know, as someone who's either been a source or been very careful not to be a source over the years, the need to sound like you know what you're talking about is so great, and the need not to admit that you don't know something is just such a danger that everybody associated with a situation like this faces. And, you know, in a way, Marty, the special thing in this incident is everything is heightened. Yeah. That you have heightened political concerns, heightened humanitarian concerns. You know, if you're a parent or a runner or a Bostonian, this hits you close to home. You're so concerned, if you're in government, in the national security establishment, you're so concerned about scapegoating in a way that could potentially have blowback overseas. At the same time, you're so concerned, you know, is there another attack? Is this person not just out there gloating, but, you know, we have no reason to think this. And as soon as that came out of my mouth, I thought, oh, I shouldn't say that on the air because I might be scaring somebody. But
right.
People are thinking about that. So you have just a tremendous number of pressures on you, which in the ideal world you would be able to deal with by not saying anything at all. But then, you know, you asked me about the responsibility media has to the public, but the policymakers also have responsibility to the public. And the challenge at a moment like this is how can you exercise those responsibilities together when the relationship is properly adversarial?
Yeah, I'll give you just a quick anecdote on how this works. By the way, I judge sources. The valuable ones are the ones who tell me frequently, I don't know.
I was
in the White House on 9/11 and accurately reported first that it was a terrorist attack and accurately predicted first that or not predicted first accurately reported first that a plane had gone into the Pentagon. I also, though, was part of the reporting that said that there was an explosion outside the State Department. And I know that information came from somebody really high up in the government who really had reason to know and was passed along the information to us thinking it was accurate and having very good reason to believe it was accurate. But the information was wrong, and therefore I was wrong that day. And that, you know, that was a bad bit of reporting.
Heather, there is this whole thing, a sense of security, whether we have a false sense of security, a correct sense of security. As someone who's part of executive director of the National Security Network, what is security in 2013?
Well, there's two answers to that. There's a wonky one and a metaphysical one, right? And the wonky one is that in terms of military threats to us, we are as safe as we have been at any time in our history. You know, we are much less likely to have a nuclear weapon used against us. We are very unlikely to have a large-scale, sophisticated, multi-city on the level of 9/11 terror plot directed against us. There's no peer enemy that the U.S. has plotting our decline. So at the wonky level, you know, we're safer than at any time in a very long time. Now at the metaphysical level, because of the economy, because we all know so much more about threats to us, and because we can all, you know, sort of disturb our psyches all the time, at a metaphysical level, we're much less secure. And then that raises the question of how do you want your security? How do you want your security establishment to deal with your psychic or metaphysical needs?
Well, which is sort of a wrestling match between perhaps the more sort of rational self that looks at this and sort of cold hard facts, and the more perhaps feeling self. Heather?
Yeah, and that's a legitimate thing. I don't at all mean to say that one of those is legitimate and one is not. They're both completely legitimate, and our job as a society is to figure out how to tend to all of our needs. It just may be that some of those needs are not best tended to with the tools that the national security establishment has to bring to bear. Even as that doesn't mean that you stop using all the tools that we have to maintain the level of safety that we actually have achieved.
I'd be curious about how you see that, Ron.
Well, I'm just thinking through. Heather's talking about how the national security, her industry, doesn't have the tools to deal with this dichotomy between the rational self and feeling self, but yeah. Neither does mine. You know, my institution, we have this huge business model problem and a huge change in how we go about doing our jobs, and that's a dichotomy that we have to keep in mind, too, and how can we best serve people? It's not just getting them the information, but also dealing with both the rational self and the feeling self.
We have about 45 seconds, Heather, and I, my understanding is the president is going to be in Boston tomorrow for a service, and presidents do this in other tragedies as well. What would you suggest he say to the country?
So he's going to say to the country that we're strong and resilient, that Boston is a very resilient place. He's going to highlight some of the things that Ron has talked about that people did. You know, my hope is, I think in addition to all of that, that he's going to remind us that we're much stronger when we're united, which is something that you can take from what happened at the finish line and from the best of what's happened since.
On that note, my thanks to you, Heather Hurlburt, for joining us today on Radio Times. Ron Fournier, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Heather Hurlburt, Executive Director of the National Security Network in Washington, D.C. Ron Fournier joining us from the studios of National Journal, where he is Editorial Director. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including things like Facebook and Twitter, a very active social media that we have as well. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour, but stay with us. We'll be right back.